This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for, and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show paramedic, FDNY firefighter, and the man behind the Burn Box, Thomas Ansu. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his early life growing up in New York, his journey into the world of EMS, entering the fire service, the importance of servant leadership, firefighter mental health, special operations, power of entrepreneurship, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Thomas Ansu. Enjoy.
Hey
Well, Thomas, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I've been a fan for a while, and it's an honor to be here and to tell my story and speak to you.
Absolutely. Likewise. So where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
So where do I live?
Yes.
Oh, all right. So currently right now, I live in Long Island, New York, Baldwin. But I was born and raised in Queens, so that's where I live most of my life. I just moved out here to Long Island, and I work in Brooklyn. So,
Brooklyn. Brilliant. Well, let's start in Queens then. So tell me about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Oh, man. So my father was like a manager of a supermarket. He's been doing that for 30, he's still working. He's like 72, still working. He's kind of the only guy working. My mom was pretty much a stay-at-home mother. She had a few jobs here and there, but nothing really serious. I have six brothers and I have four sisters.
Wow.
So I got a pretty big family growing up. We were born in Manhattan, most of us, and then we moved to Queens when I was like, I don't know, six. We moved to Queens Village, and that's kind of where we've been. That's kind of where they still are now.
Beautiful. With your dad, it's an interesting lens that he has. Have you ever had the discussion with him about how groceries have changed over the years? How, because when I was young, which is certainly, you know, before you were born, there wasn't really any food as far as, you know, organic and that kind of thing. Now, a few decades prior there was, but then you start getting all the processed food. But now when you go into a lot of supermarkets or grocery stores, you know, that finally is a thing. They don't have their own section anymore. The organic, healthier food is everywhere now. So has he had ever discussed about the kind of evolution of what's in his walls?
You know, he never really talks about his job, really. You know, he just complains that, you know, some of the cashiers don't show up and stuff like that. But my father's actually Ghanaian. He's from Ghana, West Africa. So he came here when he was 28. So he has a very different outlook on everything. He's a very like nonchalant, like nothing, you know, nothing makes him upset. He's always very cool. He just, you know, he just comes home and he's like, work was work, you know?
Now, what about his experience? Obviously, I'm an immigrant too. And I think that, you know, sometimes there's a very, irresponsible narrative when it comes to immigration in America. And, you know, a lot of this country is built on the back of immigrants from all, you know, colors and creeds. What were the kind of the highs of his immigration story? And then were there any lows as well?
I wouldn't say there was any lows. One time he got assaulted, somebody hit him with a hammer. Crazy. But it's New York, you know. I'm not sure. I was very young. I'm not sure if that had to do with him being an immigrant. But he had struggles because he has a heavy African accent. So, like, people think because he has an accent, he's stupid or something, which is a problem he has. It's a challenge he has a lot. But as far as us and our upbringing, he was just very big on education. And he wanted us to go to school. He didn't care what, like, you could be a terrible kid, but as long as you had good grades, he was okay with it. That was the one thing. He didn't get angry often, but if it came to school, that's the one thing that kind of made him upset.
See, English people have the opposite problem. Everyone thinks we're intelligent when I'm actually dumb as a box of rocks. So,
yeah, school is a big thing for him. I mean, I guess he's still disappointed in me. I didn't go to school. You know, I went to school, but I didn't go to college or anything.
Well, you went to trade school. I'd argue that's probably one of the most powerful ways of educating a child.
Yeah, but it growing up was mayhem, man. Having all those siblings and like getting ready for school, everyone fighting for the bathroom, it was a challenge every morning, you know?
Yeah, I'm one of five and I grew up on a farm. So we were kind of feral, you know, we kind of raised ourselves a little bit, but it was the same thing. You know, you become this little tribe and almost kind of separate from your parents.
Yeah, I used to wonder how did my parents do it, but things were different back then, but I think a lot of it was the older ones start to look after the younger ones. So, you know what I mean? So like my older brothers did a lot of, you know, my parents would go out, they'd watch us and it was terrible because they were terrorists. They were mean. But
what about sports? What were you playing and doing back in school age?
So one thing, I wasn't heavy into sports, like as far as school, but I was, I would go to the park. My sport of choice was basketball. I never really played for a team, but I would go to the park and always play basketball. My older brother, he was a football. I have one older brother who was big in football. Another older brother who was big into chess. But no one really took sports too seriously. But
and what about access to actual, you know, athletic areas? Because when I think of, you know, Manhattan and some of these really built up, you know, urban settings, when there's a discussion on, for example, you know, again, nutrition, and you look at what, you know, technically is a food desert in a populated city, or the ability to exercise. Now, you know, in Manhattan, obviously people are walking everywhere, but it's not like they have these lush, beautiful parks everywhere like we do here in Florida, for example. So what was, you know, what kind of parks did you have access to back then?
So Central Park in the city, was that's a pretty big a lot of people go there. In Brooklyn, where I work now, Prospect Park, a lot of people like to get out and walk around there. We have a few local parks in our neighborhood. Speaking, now that you say it, I do remember guys played roller hockey. We had like a roller hockey rink. But we did have a couple parks. I wouldn't say lush and beautiful. Concrete, most of it, and asphalt. But we found ways to get active, ride our bikes, you know, run around, play tag and stuff.
Now, did you have any exposure to the fire service when you were a kid?
I had none. Only thing is when I was a kid, no. Only time I really learned about the fire department is when I was like an adult.
So when you were in school, what were you dreaming of becoming back then?
So going to school, I was not the best student. I wouldn't say I was a bad kid. I wasn't into gangs, but I was really very silly and goofy, very immature. So what I wanted to be a business. I wanted to be go to business. I know I wanted to do business. So I think the high school I went to had like it was broken up to four different schools, and the one I went to was the business part of that school. It was in Queens, New York, and you know, they give you a few business courses. It wasn't much, but that's kind of where I wanted to go. I wanted to get into business. Found it interesting.
So walk me through the journey from graduating, wanting to go in the business world, to entering the Rock.
All right. So my older brother had became an EMT. He was in this program where if you get in trouble, like not in trouble, if you're short a few credits for like to graduate high school, you they have a program where you can get your diploma, the credits that you're shy to graduate, and you can get your EMT certification, your emergency medical technician certification. So my older brother did it. I didn't really want to do it, but I found myself following after him 2 years later. I was shy a few credits, and I kind of was being a knucklehead in school. So I said, you know, I didn't have any other options. Well, I had other options, but I figured I'd follow my brother's footsteps. I get into that program where I get my EMT credits and my diploma. And it was a challenging program because you couldn't miss any days. You couldn't be late too much. You had to keep a certain grade to stay in, but you get your EMT card and your diploma at the same time. So it was a good opportunity. I took it. I thank God I passed it. And then right after you graduate that, you go right into FDNY has a training orientation program for EMTs, for EMS. It was called TOPS class. And so right when I graduated, let's say June 1st, I was in FDNY TOPS class like the 20th of June. So and I was 18 when that happened.
And where did you find yourself assigned?
So after joining top class, I got assigned to Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, Station 35. It was in the bottom of a hospital. It was there was a station right next to it. There was two, Station 57 and Station 35. And 35 was kind of like the forgotten child of that neighborhood. So we were in the basement. It was like next to the morgue. It was gross, but now, right when I left, became a firefighter, they got a brand new station. But of course, when I leave, they get all the nice stuff. But it was a good experience, man. Bed-Stuy is a little different than it is now. It wasn't as bad as the 80s, but it was definitely a rougher neighborhood. Nowadays, it's the neighborhood's very gentrified. It's very different. It's not as bad as it was, but it was a good neighborhood to work to get experience.
What shifts were you working?
So when you first graduate, you get put on a mentor unit. So like for 90 days, you work with experienced EMTs. And then after that, then you get put on a regular line unit. So the unit I worked sat in Greenpoint, which was not too bad. But after I got off probation, I got sent into right in the heart of Bed-Stuy, Unit 37 Frank. It was a very busy unit. You got a lot of experience out doing that, man. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And was that an EMT and a medic, two of you in each unit?
No, so it's EMTs. EMTs are paired with EMTs, and medics are paired with medics. That's how it works. If you need, if you get a BLS run and you need medics, you just call for them. You know, and certain calls have medics. They have both of us on them.
Gotcha. So in that area, you said it wasn't as bad as the 80s. Talk to me about that area in the 80s, and then what were the kind of calls that you were running on in your career?
Well, back then it was big with, you know, drugs was a big thing back in the day. When I started working there, you still had your issues with drugs. It was very, very violent. So we do a lot of shootings, a lot of stabbings. You get a lot of your run-of-the-mill calls, but when I first got assigned to that bedside area, there was a lot of shootings, a lot of stabbings. You were guaranteed every weekend, you're guaranteed to get some trauma calls there. The neighborhood's not the same anymore. I don't work there anymore, but I drive through it. It's just a much nicer. It's not much going on, you know. It's definitely changed. A lot of the city's changed, to be honest.
So when you think back to that time, though, because, I mean, I think, again, back to environment, we've both seen it, you know, there are kids that you go to their parents' house on a call and you just look around and you go, oh my God, these kids are doomed to get out of this and find a positive road. When you look back at that time, what was that environment? What were the contributing factors that were resulting in addiction, you know, drug dealing and the violence around it?
Oh, man, there's a lot that contribute to that. You know, I think education is a big part of it. You know, just lack of education. There's a lot of people, hardworking families out there trying to do their best, but, you know, they don't know what they don't know. Just also the pressures of the neighborhood, right? So let's say for me, I was in my high school. I wasn't in the worst neighborhood, but my high school, you had to go through metal detectors to get in. But there would still be a mob of kids standing outside when you get out. So, yeah, you're clean. You got nothing on you. But when you're going home, you're getting robbed on the way home. That kind of principle applies. Like, you could try your best to do what you can. But if it's a lot of toxic people in your environment, you kind of have to. Sometimes you got to do things you don't want to do to survive, you know. You find a lot of people just minding their business, getting caught up in stuff. But just I think lack of education is a huge one. And I think whenever there's lack of education, lack of money in a neighborhood, it's going to breed violence, you know.
I've always found it, I think strange is even the right word, unfair, I think is the word. We're all aware of those kind of parts of town, those schools that have the metal detectors and the really bad gang membership. And there are shootings and killings outside those schools all the time. And so when you get, you know, a person walk into a school, all of a sudden it makes the news, and rightly so. It's a horrendous event, any sort of school shooting. But I always, you know, when I see those, think of, well, that's probably the tip of the iceberg for how many kids are murdered just outside of school, just like you were saying.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate. But, you know, I'm not going to act like the city or people haven't tried to make programs. There's definitely programs, after school programs and stuff out there. But is it enough? I don't know. But things have definitely changed a little bit for the better, I would say.
Now, what about mentorship and the fire service specifically? One of the best things that I've seen, and I talk about it all the time, they have a mentorship program here in Ocala, Florida, where I live, started by a friend of mine. And if you think about, for example, the diversity conversation, and FDNY was certainly one of the the ones dragged into the spotlight initially for that. You know, you ultimately, you want to find the best candidates in all the areas, all walks of life. And so when you set up mentorship programs and you remove the barriers to entry, because, I mean, here in Florida, we have to go through Fire Academy first, pay for it, and then try and get hired usually. So, you know, if you're from a poorer neighborhood, you may just simply not have the means to get to an academy, to pay for an academy. So what this does is it trains the kids free of charge, and they have a centrally located, you know, area, usually, you know, downtown. And then there are, you know, scholarships for Fire Academy, and then departments on the other end looking to hire. So it's a phenomenal program, because not only are you raising up young boys and girls that are going to be great firefighters, you're also giving them an opportunity, other girls and boys, to go, you know what, this isn't what I want to do. And that's a huge win as well. So through the FDNY lens now, have you seen mentorship programs that are, empowering kids from less or underserved neighborhoods to be able to believe that they can also be firefighters?
Yes. So that's one big thing that the fire department has made huge strides in lately. I didn't really know. I knew you see fire trucks driving by when you're a kid, but I didn't put two and two together that, you know, oh, I could do this thing. So growing up, I didn't really think that it was possible for me. I didn't have any family on it. So it was just out of sight, out of mind. But that's when I became an EMT and I was working side by side with these guys and watching some of my fellow coworkers. They were taking the promotional exam to become EMTs, become firemen. That's kind of where I was like, oh, it made it seem realistic. But the FDNY, there was a huge lawsuit and there was a hiring freeze. But they've been making a lot of strides to even the playing field as far as diversity goes. So they have huge diversity initiatives. Like my brother-in-law is waiting to get hired now, and he has a mentor. You see him on the street, like you're walking by, they have little tables set up. They're doing a lot more than I remember when I was getting hired. So it's huge. It's huge what they're doing to get spread the word, you know, just let you know that it's an option, let you know that it's something you could do. They have free training for like when the test, after you take the test, like if you want to take practice, like for the physical or practice written, like they have all that stuff available, you know, which I didn't know existed, but they really doubled down recently.
Yeah. No, I think it's important for people to hear that because those programs just seem to work so well and it just addresses all the inequities that used to occur, you know, and you think about how many great firefighters and police officers and EMTs and, you know, who other professions that we lost because we just weren't able to get into those areas. And those, you know, young men and women maybe missed the opportunity to do something that they really, you know, dreamed about. So, yeah. And then also I got a friend, Steve O'Michel, who's originally his family from Haiti, and he grew up in, I mean, the most desperate apartment complex I've ever seen in my whole career. I mean, we used to think that it was all boarded up and vacant and, you know, people would come and move the boards out the way and, you know, move a whole family in. And I mean, it literally looked like it came from a third world country. And he ended up getting into one of the Colorado colleges playing ball. And then he became a firefighter and he got himself assigned back to his neighborhood just so he could show other, you know, Haitian, you know, descent kids that you can be a firefighter. If I can do it, you can do it. So I think those messages are so, so important.
Yeah, that's huge. Like when I got into that EMT program that I was in the high school, a lot of the kids that graduated that same program, they would come back and they would just come back. They would be in uniform and they'd dress blues and they would just tell you, hey guys, this is awesome. Stay with it, stay focused. And it made a difference for sure.
Beautiful. Well, talk to me then about your transition from EMS to fire then.
Oh, okay. So when I got to my EMS station, worked there a couple months, most of the guys there, they took the promotional exam. So the way the FDNY works is they have an open competitive and then they have a promotional exam to get hired off of. Open competitive is for the general public, and the promotional is for them. They promote you from EMT paramedic to fire. I know it could be different in other states, but where I work, they promote you. The promotional comes out every 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a bit. And the open competitive is every 4 years. Whatever. So when I'm there, a lot of guys took that promotional test and they're waiting for their physical. So all they talked about around the station was they're talking about fitness, talking about their heart rates, they're getting in shape, they're talking about the run. And I'm like, what are you guys talking about? And they would just explain, hey, listen, we're trying to go to fire. And they told me all about it. They told me the benefits. They told me about the job. And that's when I really realized, I'm like, wow, this seems like a lot of fun. I think I could do this. So that's kind of how fire got put on my radar. I was an EMT for about 5 years. I took the following promotional. And then I went to paramedic school for a brief stint. So I don't know if I can call myself a paramedic. I went to the class. I passed the final, but I never worked a day as a medic. But right when I had a week left and then Fire Academy started. So I just took the final and then I went right into the Fire Academy. But that's kind of how I found out about the fire department. It's kind of how I learned about how it works, the benefits, the perks, the schedule. It just, everything that I found out about the fire department was like, I need to do this. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you had a hell of a skill set to bring into the fire service, though, whether you worked as a medic or not. I mean, that's still, you know, tools in the toolbox.
Yes. Yeah, I was already helping people. So it was just like another way to help people, you know.
So when you look back on the EMT side before we get, you know, to the fire side now, what were some of the, you know, what we would call career calls you had in those 5 years?
So, yeah, I was very young. I was 18, man. I had delivered my first, like, right when I got off that probation unit, that training unit, my first tour, I delivered a baby. And I'm like, it was like, it was me and another intern. So it's like both of us, it was strange. But it's messed up, man, because you're there at people's worst. So when you say career calls, are you asking like just some of the calls that stand out?
Yeah, because I mean, the worst thing you can ask any of us is what's the worst thing you've seen? So it's not about that. It could be, you know, like you said, delivering a child. Like, for example, one of my shifts, I was on, I think I was on shift, and then I went to my medic ride along. I extubated a terminally ill patient. So I basically took a life, and then I delivered a baby and brought life into this world, all within about, you know, 24 hours of each other. So that's one thing, not horrific, but it was just, you know, a memorable thing. And obviously there's, I'm writing my second book. I literally was writing about one of my worst calls just like an hour before we sat down. That was fucking awful. But so yeah, just anything that you, when you look back, you know, was powerful to you.
Oh, so yeah, that was a big one, just the delivering a baby. But I don't know, man. It's just, what comes to mind is I can go on and tell you about all the shootings, the stabbings, but it just for me, it puts me in a strange mindset, because you start to see how people treat each other, and that, you know, that if you're not strong enough, that could mess with you a little bit. So a lot of the, I'll be honest with you, a lot of the runs and a lot of the calls, they all kind of blend together. All the stuff that deal with kids are probably the worst. Those really cut the most, you know, those are never fun. But yeah, it just puts a different perspective on the way you see life. You see life differently when you start that job. I really like the job, honestly. I'll be honest with you. Don't tell anybody. Right? You guys in the past, they hear this, go back. But I had a good partner. You know, you listen to music in between calls or while you're driving around. I didn't mind it. My department at the time, it was a little crab in the barrel. Like, you know, people were kind of going after each other, but which completely changed when I joined the suppression side. But yeah, I really liked it. It was not every day you had to be scooping up gunshot victims, you know. It didn't have to be all that, which it isn't 90% of the time.
One of my strongest memories, I'd be interested to see if you had the same thing when you were in the ambulance. I remember driving up Orange Blossom Trail in Orlando, which is our kind of red light district, and, you know, a lot of poverty and violence as well. And we're driving up in what we call the rescue. So it's an ambulance with firefighter gear on it. And I just remember, you know, like sex workers and gang members all just like waving to us when we were going by. I'm like, there is not another vehicle on planet Earth that the most desperate people in society would wave to. But at the end of the day, if something horrific happens to them, we're the very last people that they're probably going to see, hopefully save their life. So did you have that? I mean, obviously you're working in a pretty rough neighborhood. Was there a kind of reverence of you guys and in your profession specifically amidst a lot of this desperation?
I didn't really get that too much when I was driving an ambulance, unfortunately. That's like when you become a firefighter, you're like a local celebrity. Everyone waves, stops and waves. But I'll be honest, it's sad to say, like, law enforcement has it pretty bad. So we didn't have it as bad as law enforcement, because it's like a thankless job those guys have right now. It's tough. I didn't really have that happen when I was in EMT. No one's ever really happy to see you. When you pull up in an ambulance, people are kind of screaming, like, hurry up, you know? Mm-hmm. Hurry up.
Yeah, it's funny, though, like you said, about being told to go back when you're a firefighter, because over here, we get to be both simultaneously. So I'm a firefighter paramedic. But there is this kind of rhetoric about, oh, I don't want to do EMS, I just want to do fire, especially when we are dual certified here. But I always say, okay, well, you make the most heroic, you know, rescue. You do a right-hand search, you drag them out onto the front porch, now what? You just remove the corpse until an EMT or a paramedic and ultimately doctors and nurses interact and hopefully save that person's life. So I never understood that kind of anti-EMS sentiment, because ultimately, whether you like it or not, you save lives in the back of a rescue.
You're 100% right. And I think everybody knows that deep down. They just don't want to, you know, what it is. We're here to help people, you know, and you probably have a better chance bringing somebody back doing CPR versus you. Like, how often are you dragging people out of fires, you know? Well, I guess it depends on where you work. But
yeah. Yeah. I've only dragged dead people out of fires, so I'm 0 for whatever now. Well, then one more question before we move to fire. When you look back now with this mature perspective that you have, an 18-year-old boy being thrust into that world straight away, there's conversations about the fact that our brains haven't kind of matured yet. And I was just by chance, I didn't get into the fire service till I was 27. So I, you know, my poor little tiny brain had been given some chance to mature. But there is a lot of conversation about, are we putting, you know, our kids into first responder professions too early and exposing them to trauma where maybe they're not quite ready yet? So what's your perspective starting so young yourself and being thrust into a pretty, pretty desperate area?
Ah, man. So I don't know. I never said this before, but I remember I was in a bad place, man. Everything was just seeing so much. I would just remember mentally just being in a bad place. So I get mental health is huge for us. Luckily it didn't send me off the deep end. So, you know, I was able to bounce back, but I do remember being like 19, 20, and just in my mind, I just like nothing made sense to me. I was like, what's the point? You know, I remember being in a bad headspace at that time. I don't know what pulled me out of it, to be honest with you, but I do remember that. Looking back, I do remember just thinking to myself, you know, how important mental health is, man. Mental health is huge, man. It's kind of an issue we're having now. You know, every now and then, unfortunately, we're having guys who succumb to challenges they face, you know.
I've seen a few FDNY death notifications, and it breaks my heart, because every time there's not an explanation of what happened, you know, it's either, you know, it's a suicide or an overdose, you know, basically. So, and those are the same things to me. They're exactly the same. It's a mental health crisis. But, you know, when you look back and you think that, like, I've got a 16-year-old at the moment who's a junior. So all you knew until 18, as you said, you're even doing some extra credits to make sure that you graduate. All you knew was the classroom and then, you know, summer break and that kind of thing. And so when you transition out and they're like, Thomas, all right, here's the real world now. And your echo chamber is everyone's worst night, worst day. That, how is that not going to, you know, skew your perspective of the world?
Yeah, I remember for maybe a year straight, I just remembered being this. I was probably a terror to be around. I was just like, oh, what's the point? Kind of like, but yeah, thank God I didn't stay there long, you know? But yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that, because I think, you know, all of us go through stuff, you know, but when, and if you had this when you were younger, you know, we look at the other guys and girls and we're like, well, they're all fine. Why am I the one that's going through this? But none of us are fine. How can you? You're going to be a sociopath if you were fine, like truly fine, unfazed by all the horrific things that we see.
I think something that could be beneficial, if I could give a piece of advice to like my younger self, would be just to get a support system, you know, even if, you know, just to have somebody or have a group of people, even if it's your family, just try to, it's probably easier said than done. But if I had a better support system, you know, maybe it would have helped me like navigate that a little better. But that's the one piece of advice. Try to get a support system, a couple people you trust to help you work through things, you know?
Absolutely. And especially outside the fire service. I think people don't realize that when you're in a crew getting beat down, you know, once every 3 days, 24 hours, you're all in the same meat grinder. So you're not a good barometer on how each of you is doing, but your family members and your friends, they're the ones that be like, wow, you look like shit today. What's going on? You need that honesty.
Yeah. Yeah. Mental health, man. Yeah. But It was a dual. I mean, I had honestly, it's I haven't really thought about those days in a while. You know, you're bringing up, thinking back of all that stuff, man. I had a lot of good memories working EMS, but I do remember, you know, it can't weigh on you. I know I didn't go through it particularly. I know when COVID happened, a lot of EMTs had a hard time as well, just with the stuff that they saw, you know, and the runs they were running, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again for your transparency there. Moving on to the fireside then, and I absolutely adore the fireside too. You know, you do this promotional test. You, like myself, had no real family in fire, so I didn't really know. You know, I just knew Ladder 49 and Backdraft. That's about the only introduction I got to the American Fire Service. So what was your transition like? Walk me through your probation there and then where you were assigned.
Okay. So the Fire Academy was it was interesting. You know, it was fun, challenging. I got assigned to Engine 290, Ladder 10, Engine 290, Firehouse is 290-103 in East New York, Brooklyn, back to Brooklyn. It was a busy shop. Everyone says they're in a busy shop. You ask anybody in FG, where do you work? You know, it was busy. Funny enough, the engine I worked, they did a lot of EMS calls. And they also did a decent amount of fire. It's one of the tougher houses on the job. So I'm super grateful I got sent there because even though we ran around a lot, there was a lot of training, a lot of drilling, and I learned discipline there. Just, you know, I learned how to be disciplined and focused, and I learned to pay attention to the small details. There was a lot of little details, and, you know, if you don't pay attention, they all start to add up. And I'm glad, because I think if I went somewhere that was really laid back, I'd probably be, you know, wherever I went is what I would have came, you know? And I'm glad I went there because it taught me all the stuff I need that kind of helped me move forward.
What was it about the officers or the leaders in the station that created that culture? Because if I hear EMS, I hear, you know, high frequency of fire, but I also hear training and drilling, which I think is so important, even more important if you're in a quiet station. So when you think back as far as leadership, you know, what were the qualities that created that culture?
So one thing I noticed immediately when I got in the fire service and I got walked in that firehouse, it felt like the guys, the bosses were working with you, you know, if like they'll be on the hose, humping the hose with you versus when I was on the other side, it was kind of guys are telling you what to do. You know, it felt like the higher ups were with you. Like, so the captain we had, he just retired actually like a month ago. He never raised his voice. One thing that was huge is if you did what you're supposed to do, he would always go to bat for you no matter what, which was huge, which I wasn't used to. And again, the big thing for me was just feeling like the guys, the bosses, they earned your respect because they were doing it with you. They wouldn't ask you to do anything that they wouldn't do.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of my favorite crew, I'll be completely honest, in Anaheim, California. My captain was exactly the same. He was a ginger wrestler when he was younger, you know, construction his whole life as well, and, you know, big old bushy red mustache, and he would just get off and you know, look around, and then he'd just say like three words and he knew exactly what needed to be done. But just like you said, he never raised his voice. We'd have to fight him at the kitchen sink for the dishes, you know, fight him for the brush on the rig. I mean, you name it, but that's a leader, that's not a boss. And I think that's the difference.
Another thing that I really loved about my firehouse, that first firehouse I got sent to, was they had, like most firehouses have it, but it was just like I've never experienced it before, like the sense of pride that everyone had. You know, everyone had a sense of pride, and it was, so it wasn't just about, it's like if you got detailed out, you were representing that company. So they made sure you were squared away all across the board. And if you're associated with this firehouse, it's, you know, it's going to be associated with, you know, professionalism. And that was huge.
Absolutely. I always remember just that feeling and that crew, for example, that feeling when you get on scene that you can just tell people are glad that your crew got on scene, you know, that you added value to that crew or that scene rather than others that I've seen told to get off the scene because they were removing so much value at that moment.
Yeah, Yeah, it's exactly that. I'm super grateful for. Somebody must have liked me. I'm very grateful I got sent there. It definitely set the trajectory for me.
So where were you after that?
So I was there for about 8 years, and I just recently got sent over to Squad 1, also in Brooklyn, Park Slope. I've been there for about 2 years now, 2 or 3 years now. And special operations, we have squads and rescues and stuff. So it's a little extra training, a little extra equipment. But you got to have a minimum of 5 years, and they like, you know, you got to have some experience. You know, they don't want to teach you basic firefighting. You got to have that squared away before you get there. And when I got there, I was just so grateful because a lot of stuff, I didn't feel behind the eight ball at all. Well, with some of the newer stuff, the technical stuff, I didn't know, obviously, but a lot of the stuff, I was prepared. I was well prepared coming from the house I came from, so I was super grateful.
So what was the skill set for a squad specifically? Because I know we use all these different terms depending on where we are in the country. So what would a squad company be responsible for?
So squad companies they're like basically a manpower pool. So we pull up to the command post. We pretty much do whatever needs to get done. We have basic assignments, right? We have assignments that we have kind of in stone. But if we get there and the chief has something else for us to do, we kind of take on that task. So, for example, if it's a five-story building, first duel goes to the first floor. Second duel goes to the second floor, right? Who's checking 3, 4, and 5, you know? Like, we could get sent to go check the upper floors. Or if it's a roll of stores, right? Maybe first duel's in fire building, second duel goes to exposure 2. Like, who's checking the other stuff? So we kind of fill in the gaps. Squads operate in their first due response area as an engine, but aside from that, you know, we operate pretty much like a truck. And we respond to any fires in the borough on our half of the borough. So we split the borough with Squad 252. So on our half of the borough, any fire calls, we go there, operate as a squad. But in our first response area, we operate as an engine.
Who normally gets assigned RIT? And I've had, you know, varying dynamics in the four departments I work for. Sometimes it was a special operations guy. Sometimes it was, you know, one or two rescues put together. So what about with your borough?
So we have the squads, right? And again, we're like a manpower pool. We kind of just fill the gaps to get things done. Rescues, if I'm not mistaken, these guys were made, they were created to save firemen. They do way more now, right? The command has grown, but that's kind of, so when they get assigned, there's one rescue in every borough, and they get assigned to every fire, and they kind of go there. And that's kind of one of the things that they do. But we, on our regular assignments, we have a fast team. So our third responding truck, they operate as the fast team, or you guys would say RIT. So surprisingly, the fast truck doesn't get put to work often. Thank God, it's a good thing, but our third responding truck on every fire is the fast team or the RIT team.
Has there been an increase in conversation on rope rescue after the thing you had two recently?
Oh, man. I remember being in probie school. I remember being in the academy thinking, we're never going to do this. Outboard stuff. We're never sending anybody over. And then since I've been a fireman, it's probably been like 5 or 6. It's just... Yeah, whenever something big like that happens, something, you know, like that, it's fairly rare, and it's probably one of the more dangerous things we do. Yeah, it goes job wide. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's asking what this guy did. How did he set it up? You know, it's good. It's good to get people talking. It's good for maybe the companies that are people who are engines who don't really do rope stuff. You know, it's good to get everyone talking, drilling on it again. But I was on vacation when it happened, so I was kind of out of the loop, but the most recent one.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, now you're wearing a firefighter uniform, engine, and then squad. Again, career calls, ones that you really remember.
I guess the ones that I really remember, and it's nothing glamorous. It's, ones that stick out as your first fire, right? I remember the boss, and I remember him talking to me, like, you want to get in there and just put the fire out, and he's kind of telling you relax. He's telling you look at the flames. He's kind of talking you through it. Like, those are things I remember. I remember, I don't know what we how how graphic we can get. I remember my first couple fires, I never had people jump. That was people jumping out of windows. That was a strange feeling. Or even if you're outside, you're waiting for water and you could hear the crowd, everyone go, ooh, and you're like, people are jumping. That kind of, those things kind of stick out to me. What else? I don't know if you're looking for good stories, man. I'm just talking.
No, and talk anything, anywhere you want to go, I simply open the door.
It's like a lot of the earlier stuff, that's kind of what sticks into my mind. Because after a while, everything is kind of like, you know, it all kind of blends together. But I would say this, like some of the best people and smartest people I've met in the, like, are on the fire department. Like, I've met some really rock stars, some really smart people, really brave people, man, who think of things that I don't even think about. It's like, you have people on this job who are like chemists and stuff like that. Like, there's some real brilliant people working on the fire department, man. And I'm glad I've had the pleasure of working in firehouses with some of these people.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned first fire. I think one of the first fires I had in my first apartment, I had to buy cake and ice cream. And then I can't remember some of the other ones. I think maybe steak and lobster was one of them, which was really expensive for a probie with almost no money. And then Orange County, you had your t-shirt ripped off you. So what's the tradition when your first fire in your department?
There's no tradition. Maybe it's no tradition. At least my firehouse, they kind of tell you, you did your job, shut up, right?
I like that more. It's cheaper.
Get back in the sink, you know? You know? But even though they don't say it, they know. Like, they know. Yeah, they know. A big thing when you get sent to an engine, they want to see what you're made of, right? They want to see your stuff. And, like, once guys see that, you're not going to – guys want to make sure you're not going to give up, you know? You don't got to be the greatest in the world, but they got to make sure you're not going to give up. And once you kind of show what you got, they ease up a little bit.
Now, you still at the firefighter rank at the moment?
Yeah, still at the firefighter rank.
See, I stayed that for 14 years and I love that position. And I just, you know, I mean, I moved around, so that kind of took me away from the draw of promotional tests. But when I really evaluated myself, I still absolutely love going inside, going on roofs and cutting, you know, being on the tool and extrication. So I just never lost that desire to just stay in that one seat. But certainly, I don't know if it's the same with you, but down here, with the high turnover, you know, a lot of these departments, they're 50% or so, like at 5 years or less, and people are kind of racing to promote. I asked Al Benjamin this, who was on the show quite a while ago now, a real senior man, you know, rescue legend. But you don't hear that often about the concept of the senior man. Now, I know, you know, you probably don't consider yourself that, but you're starting to get towards that point now. Talk to me about the value of staying at the firefighter rank up to this point.
Yes. Yeah, so one thing I also loved about the firehouse is everyone respects the men. I mean, respects the bosses, but the men run the house. You know, the men run the house. Everything gets ran by the senior men, the higher ups, before it goes to, you know, the bosses where they have to, like, you know, put pen to paper. But, like, if you're in a really good firehouse, like, it's got to be cakewalk as a boss, right? The men make sure that meals are done, make sure the house is clean, make sure the drills are getting done. Of course, the bosses have their say in everything. But it's huge because, say, for instance, like, my company I'm in now, we're in a weird place, a transition where a lot of the people with time are retiring. It just is what it is. They're leaving. And it's kind of like there's so much stuff that I haven't seen, so many things I haven't experienced yet. And these guys have all that knowledge that they could kind of, like, you know, pass on, and then, you know, they're leaving. So unfortunately, the job turns over quick, but you know how it is, man. You just got to get on the rig and do what you have to do. But yeah, the senior man is it's so much value senior men bring, because they just seen so much, and they know, like, a big thing with being a firefighter, you don't have to be the strongest guy. You gotta be smart. You know, a lot of these senior guys, You'll be pulling ceilings, breaking your back, pulling ceilings, and you see a senior guy with a cigar in his mouth just coming like nothing, you know, pull a room. It's experience, man. It's nothing like it.
Yeah, no, it is amazing, you know, and whether it's a captain or an engineer or a firefighter, and I think this is the thing too. I know lots of people with lots of time on that aren't, you know, that aren't senior man quality. They've just been there for a long time. And then, you know, there's also people that have come from different departments that have, you know, when a company with humility that are incredibly invaluable, and they may only have, you know, 3 years on your department. But that experience and that knowledge sharing and that humility, I think, is so important. And it kind of breaks my heart a little bit, you know, when people are barely at that firefighter level. Now they're riding up as an engineer. Now they're getting, you know, they're promoted to an engineer after 2 years, and now they get to ride up as an officer. And you've got like 4 years in the front seat. That's, you know, it's terrifying. So I think pumping the brakes on that and just being proud of the firefighter position, that you're in no rush. And I get the financial side. I understand it. But did you dream of a certain pay raise when you were in fire academy, or were you dreaming about saving lives? So I love it when I meet firefighters that just aren't in a rush, that are just enjoying that position like I did.
That's exactly it. Not in a rush. The test was coming out. I did start studying. I'm always the type of guy, I take every opportunity that comes my way. So like, even with the paramedic, like I take anything. But when the test came, you know, COVID and stuff happened, things got pushed away. And I just had time to think, and I was really starting my business. And I don't know if this sounds bad. I didn't have any drive to be a boss. I didn't have any drive to do it. It's nothing against them. You know, I just didn't want to do it. I'm having a good time to fight my new firehouse. I'm learning a lot. I'm still learning. I just didn't have the drive to do it. But I felt like if I needed this things, I hope I don't regret this, but I could be studying the books, but I don't know. I'm like, I could be researching marketing. I could be researching things that are going to help me with my business, which I really have a big passion for business. So I was like, you know what? I want to bet on myself, and I want to kind of like focus there, you know? I'll take the next test when it comes out.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to regret it at all. I mean, it's always going to be there. But I mean, for me, you know, where we are, you know, you're not looking at, you know, brownstones and high rises. You're looking at, you know, single story family dwellings, either side of about 1,500 square feet. So when we pull up on a fire, you know, me and my partner are going to be the ones pulling hose and making entry and going in. The engineer is at the panel, and the LT is going to be on the radio. So of those three positions, I want to be the one on the hose going in. I don't want to be standing looking at a gauge, and I don't want to be talking to dispatch. That's just me. So, you know, so that's just it. And it kept me going. And like you said, you know, when you've got 14 years on, you're like, I've barely seen anything. That's 14 years. And yes, I've seen a lot, but nothing compared to my 30-year captain, for example. So, you know, that's what kept me going, is I don't want to be taken away from a position where I've got the highest chance of being hands-on and truly helping someone in crisis when I've got so much to learn still.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, you mentioned your business. So as a side note, before we dive into what you're doing now, I love the concept of people forging a second, you know, hobby, you know, entrepreneurial project, you know, business, whatever you, however much you commit, for two reasons. Firstly, the identity reason, because we are firefighters, is what we do. And it's absolutely hands down the greatest profession on planet Earth, but it's not who we are. And so when you create another project, you're kind of breaking that facade a little bit, because you are, you know, Thomas, who is a firefighter and was also, you know, an entrepreneur. But also when you do transition out, it's an injury, you got fired, you know, you made it to retirement. Now you have that to transition to. And I think one of the worst things that we do in our profession is we go all in on the job, and then one day the bay door closes behind us and we're like, well, now what? So that, I just want to kind of preface this conversation with those two observations. I love the fact of anyone, you know, doing something else on the side, as long as it doesn't obviously become more important than the fire service while they're in uniform. So talk to me about that. You were studying business when you were young. You become an EMT, arguably a paramedic, and then a firefighter. Talk to me about the creation of Burn Box.
So back to when I first got to my first firehouse, there was a couple of gentlemen there who had their own like firefighter products. I don't know if you've seen like that Halligan bottle opener. I work with a gentleman who owns that company. A few guys had their own fabrication companies. Guys are making tools, you know, there's some few tools on the rig that some guys jimmy rigged together, you know, for like different type of hydrant plug. like firefighters are the most creative bunch of people. And you know, every firefighter has like three jobs. So I just got on Instagram one day and I'm searching firefighter owned products. And then I saw so many different brands where guys have apparel companies, guys making tools like wedges and shove knives. There's guys doing like, you know, cups. There's guys making pliers. There's so many different things came up when I was looking up firefighter owned products. I thought it'd be really cool if I could like curate all these products and like ship them out. The goal is if I could get one day get 10,000 people signed up, and let's say Joe Fireman's making a tool in his garage and I can get the exposure, I can get that out to 10,000 people. I thought that'd be really cool. So that's kind of what started it. And that's kind of what the goal is, to help support firefighter owned businesses.
I had Trevor Williams on the show from Williams Key. And firstly, my God, that guy's life story is amazing. And he's a good looking dude as well. He's what women think of when they think of a firefighter calendar, not my ugly ass. But yeah, so that's a perfect example, though. You know, you get a guy who comes from the carpentry world and locksmithing, and then he finagles a tool to start getting, you know, the keyless entry into some of these places without destroying their doors. And now you have all the products that he's had. So talk to me about some of the companies that you've interacted with that you've used in the burn box that you really like.
Yeah, Trevor he's an absolute beast, man. Like, he doesn't stop. He doesn't stop working. He's always working on something new, but he's great. I've worked with him a couple of times. I've worked with a few apparel companies like Hook and Irons Apparel. Those guys I work with a lot. Axe Head Threads, they're a pretty popular print shop. As far as tools go, Jobtown Tools, he's another FDNY fireman, retired. He makes a lot of tools. Who else? Oh, man, I can go on and on. I work with Modus Fire Rescue. Who else do I work with? I'm drawing a blank. But I've worked with many firefighter-owned companies. The beauty is just, I love it whenever I send a box out and customers get it and they say, oh, I didn't know this existed. Or I send a box out and I get an email saying, hey, I used this thing twice already. Thank you. That's what keeps me going, man. That's the goal, you know, spread the word and provide discovery.
I think it was about 5-6 years ago now. I think it was Christmas. My wife and kids got me a present, and it was a little crate. And inside were four beer glasses that said Gearing Dog's Bollocks Brewery, which is Dog's Bollocks is something we say when it's really good in England. And then there was, you know, the mats, and then there was a couple of bags of nuts or something. But it was such a unique, interesting gift, you know, because, I mean, especially now when we have Amazon and everything, how many of us just buy things straight away? So talk to me about the concept of burn box, you know, and what people would be receiving every month.
Okay, so basically what I try to do is give you something that you could use every month, like try to give you a functional piece of tool, functional tool or piece of gear. So like I've done fire hoods, I've done pliers, I've done multi-tools, we've done shove knives, Williams Key, we've done webbing, I try to give you something, at least one thing that you could use that day when you get your box. I try to make it a satisfying package, so I also try to do a piece of apparel. So that could be a t-shirt, a hat, or a belt. And then you got your other items like, you know, your keychains, your tumblers, your coasters, your bags, and stuff like that. I try to make it a satisfying package every month. I don't want to be the tool of the month. I don't want to be the shirt of the month. I try to get a couple brands, a couple things to send. It's about a $55 to $65 box, but it's valued at like $75 to $100 depending on the month. And the goal is just to spread discovery, functionality, and it's another way to support other firefighter-owned businesses.
Talk to me about from day one how you grew it. Like, how did you go from having this idea to actually putting it in action?
So I had the idea for like 2 years before I actually pulled the trigger on it. I had the idea for 2 years. I didn't pull the trigger on it. And one day, I made a change and I said, you know what, enough's enough. I used to do a lot of partying. I was big. I was one of the guys in the firehouse who liked to always hang out. I quit boozing and stuff. And I started focusing, trying to get focused. So I started the burn box just to keep busy. And I started it. I'll be honest with you. I didn't think anybody was going to subscribe. I didn't think, you know, or more than a month. And then I just tried to be strategic. I tried to partner with brands that had a following. I tried to do cross promotion. Brands that like, so three different brands have 20,000 followers. I figured if I put them all in my box, I'd have 60,000 people potentially looking at it. So I did all that. It was, I had the idea for a long time. It took, I'll be honest, it took a while for me to get the strength to launch it, you know, because who wants to fail? And that goes out to anybody who has the, you know, a dream, wants to start something, you know, just go for it. But that's what I did. And first month got 40 people signed up. I thought I was going to have more. Had 40 people. And then like every month it just kept doubling. And I think we're rounding out about maybe 2,200 right now. So it's doing okay. It's getting harder to find products the more I grow, but it's a challenge and I'm having fun.
Now, what about the curve? Because for example, when I started the podcast, you know, it went from one download to two downloads to four downloads, you know, and that there's this facade of overnight success, you know, in business, in podcasting and everything, you know. And then you look, for example, you see someone who's in three films that year and you're like, wow, they must have, you know, they got their big break. And then, you know, five months later, you see them on some Disney TV show and oh, they've been acting for 20 years. You know, and it's just that was their day. So, because it's very, very discouraging, I think, because we are sold this kind of overnight success facade, and it can really kind of take the wind out of people's sails when the first month they see 40 orders, for example. So, what kept you going if you had higher expectations than what had originally happened?
Well, the main thing is, I think if you're going to start something, I think you could probably attest to this, because I'm sure recording a podcast consistently isn't, you know, easy, but consistency is huge. And I guess I want to say the word fortitude, because you have to have a passion for it, because when it gets hard, that passion's what's going to keep you going. Because if not, I'll be lying if I said I didn't have months where I just didn't want to do it anymore. The day before shipping, a product is missing or broken. You know, what are you going to do? I got to find a couple hundred of these. You know, it's not all. It's that passion that's going to keep you going when it doesn't look good. So if you're going to start something, just make sure it's something you're passionate about. I know everyone says that, but I think that passion is what's going to carry you through when things aren't looking good, because you're going to have a lot of bad days. It might be a strip of like a week or two in a row. Just nothing's going right, you know? And everything in your body's telling you to shut this down. You got to be passionate about it and to keep going. Because I'm fortunate that I have a job. So I was able to take risks, more risks with the business than I needed to, because, my family was going to eat no matter what. I have a job, right? So, you know, maybe the first year wasn't the best year, but it was a learning. I learned, you know, I was building proof of concept. I was learning the ins and outs of stuff. And I was fortunate enough that I have a job where I could, you know, my family's fine. So that would be a piece of advice. Just make sure if there's something that you're into, just be passionate about it, because that passion is what's going to carry you through the days you don't feel like getting up. You don't feel like sending those emails, you know, dealing with unhappy customers. One month I had sent out a couple hundred boxes. The wrong shirts. Everyone got the wrong shirt size. Like, like everything in me wanted to say it. This is it. This is it, you know. But it's, you know, you just got to keep going, you know.
I do. I've actually literally, I mean, recently told, you know, turned to my son or my wife who's ever around at that moment. You know, when it's 11:30 at night, midnight, and I'm still finishing editing because I've had technical problems and I'm, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to put this podcast on the same days that I've said, you know, for the last 7 years now. And I just turn to him and say, this is what people don't see. This is why, like you said, their consistency. It's easy to be consistent on the good days. It's can you be consistent on the shit ones?
That's so true, man. And it's also like you said, you do all this work for this many years and then people see you and you're an overnight success. Like they have no idea. Like a lot of people, like the subscription, a lot of people told me they had the idea, but they just, you know, it's a lot of work. How do you get all these vendors and all these products And I would sit up to 3-4 in the morning. I have notebooks of just me just planning the stuff out. And no one sees that. No one ever know. I have those books of the weeks I've stood up trying to run the numbers and make it work, you know?
Yeah.
Building boxes, you know.
Well, like they say, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. So I think yeah. You know, when you actually start something like this, you kind of get a new respect for people that have built things from nothing.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yep.
All right. Well, I want to go to some closing questions, and obviously we'll talk about where people can get the Burn Box. But before we do, is there a book or are there books that you'd love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Oh, man. So I'll be honest, I'm not a big book guy, but there are two books that I've read recently. And they're nothing fancy, nothing. But there's an entrepreneur out there, Alex Hormozi. He has a book called $100 Million Offers, and then he has another book called $100 Million Leads. And that's it's all about sales stuff. Those are the two recent things I read, and it's kind of like changed my perspective. That's for anybody who's thinking about entrepreneurship and stuff. He breaks everything down in an easy way to consume it, like hard concepts, he breaks it down. And a lot of those things in his book I was doing, but I didn't know I was doing it. So it was interesting.
I meant to ask you, just reminded me, what about marketing? What's worked for you and what hasn't?
So in the beginning, cross promotion was big, just partnering with other brands and just putting a bunch of people together with, you know, strategically that worked, but eventually it plateaued where I had to get a marketing agency. I wanted to learn how to do marketing myself. I took a course and everything to run my own ads, but the issue I'm having is time. I have 3 boys. I'm married. I just got to a newer firehouse. I'm running a business. I just didn't have the time to learn the way I wanted to. So I ended up hiring a marketing agency, and they kind of been helping me out with that for the most part.
I found, and this might be different because I don't put out a product per se. I mean, it is, but you know, it's a free podcast, but I've got up to, I think it's like 168 something thousand people on Instagram, for example. Community, I hate that word, followers, because no one's following me. I'm not follow worthy. So the community is there. But every time I put something out of value that's informative to say, you know, hey, look at this thing, or, you know, hey, there's this fundraiser coming up, it's like crickets. But, you know, you put the kitten on the skateboard video out there and everyone loses their mind. And so the algorithms are so shifted. So what I've realized is that, you know, there's, again, this facades that, oh, man, if, you know, this one influencer, if they do one post and you're going to blow up, like, no. So to me, I don't know if you've had this, one of the most powerful marketing tools is back to word of mouth. It's trust. If people like what you do or what you sell, they will tell other people, but obviously that's not going to blow up. That's a much slower burn.
That's the truth, man. You're dropping gems, because that's another thing. So sometimes I get people who want to, you know, give me product for the boxes, which is great. But some people, like, their products try to fix a problem that doesn't exist. So, you know, you got to let them down easy. Hey, say, listen, I don't think it's going to be a good fit, but like, I have to make sure I keep goodwill with my customers. I can't just put anything in the boxes. It has to be something I can see myself using or being functional. And because if I don't keep goodwill with my customers, they're not going to recommend me. They're not going to tell anybody else to try it. So, yeah, what you said is very true. Word of mouth is huge, you know?
Absolutely. All right, back to the closing questions. What about movies and documentaries? Any of those that you love?
Oh, man, I don't really have anything off the top of my mind, man. Movies or documentaries. I don't know if it's, it doesn't really pertain to business. I'll be honest with you, I haven't really watched anything recently, man. I think the last documentary I watched was like The Social Dilemma. And it has to do with, like, you know, the way social media works, but I don't know if that's that's going to add any value to anybody.
No, I think it will. That's a great recommendation. I mean, the fact that you've got these designers, these programmers that created this software that now they have to shield their own children from because it's so damn effective. If that's not a powerful message, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I think one eye-opening thing I had to realize is that I thought for a while I didn't realize that we are the commodity that Facebook sells. Like, I thought it was the other way around. Like, they're showing us stuff. No, like, Pepsi will call and say, you know, I need my product to go in front of X amount of people, you know? And that's how, yeah, it woke me up.
Yeah. That's interesting, actually. Well, we're sitting here, you know, and we both in professions that serve, you know, and both trying to provide products that add value to the world. It makes it even harder to understand that unethical business model, you know, whether it's social media and kind of mining people's personal information, or whether it's selling OxyContin or McDonald's or whatever it is, that, you know, people can sleep at night counting their money, knowing that they've made people's lives worse. And then back to what we talked about earlier, I had an aha moment recently, like, oh, that's also part of the mental health crisis. The reason why some people are okay with Americans dying from their products is because they themselves are probably going through a mental health struggle, but they're just billionaires, so no one's really paying attention.
Yeah, it's so many levels to this stuff, man. And it just makes you feel so small, you know, compared to these machines that are out there, machines.
Yeah. I'll put this to you. I really think that there is a paradigm shift towards what's that term people use? Oh my goodness, I'm blanking on the term. But anyway, you know, back to the family-owned butcher or baker, or you know, the coffee shop or the brewery, and places where people can sit down and talk. Because you think about the American shopping mall, it wasn't really, I mean, I know like teenagers would hang out there, but it wasn't really a place that people would go and interact. They would go, they'd sift through racks of stuff and shelves of stuff. They'd fill carrier bags and then they'd walk out a lot broker than they walked in. So I hope bespoke, that's that word, bespoke. So that kind of artisan craftsperson, I think there's a real desire to go back to that. I think like industry got so, so big that it lost all personality. And so I think that's why you're seeing a lot of these. And I just shared a video the other day of a coffee company that's owned by a family that had 3 special needs kids. And so every branch of this coffee store employs people with, you know, autism and Down syndrome and some of these other things. What a beautiful, you know, social business model. That I truly think is what people are yearning for. So everyone like you and other people out there that are trying to start something up from the ground that's coming from a good place and is small, I hope this is our time again now. Because I think the, you know, as the Macy's and all these other places start falling, because they are, you know, I think it's time to regain that small village, you know, community that we had a few decades ago.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like with social media, everything's just so fast paced with like a TikTok culture where everything is just fast. Everything's just fast the way we operate. And, you know, it's good to have, you know, companies, businesses that have a soul, you know, a face and a soul behind it. It means more, you know?
Absolutely. All right. Well, speaking of great people, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I think what comes right now is Bill Walters. He's the owner of Jobtown Tools. He's a retired firefighter. He's out in, I'm not sure if he might have moved. I'm not sure. But he's out in Long Island as well.
Brilliant. I will look him up.
Yeah, I'll see if I'll message him.
Yeah, please. Excellent. Thank you. All right. Well, in the very last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and Burnbox, what do you do to decompress?
Oh, what do I do to decompress? I don't. That's my problem. I don't. I will say something I'm doing now to decompress. So my kids, my boys, like they're into this, like, so I used to watch a show, don't laugh, don't judge me. They used to watch a show, Pokemon, when I was a kid. So like they're at that age where they're doing that and kind of they're into it. So whenever they're out playing and stuff, I kind of like sitting in there hanging with them. It kind of helps me relax. Reminds me of simpler times, you know. I buy them cards so they can open up. They kind of want to do like a YouTube video. So I'm trying to help them with that. I guess spending time with my kids, I guess.
Love
when
it.
When they're not running around like lunatics.
My son got into Pokemon, but I don't think he ever understood how to play it, and I sure as hell didn't. So we used to just make up games with it. We were doing it so wrong, but you know, he'd always win as well. He'd always give me all the crap cards, and he'd figure out how to have the good ones. So even without the right rules, I still lost, but it was quality time, just like you said.
Yeah, that's how I spent most of my vacation. Whenever they finished their homework, they'll grab some cards, and we'd just sit and hang out.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then for people listening, where can they find Burnbox? And then where can they find you as well on social media?
Oh, yeah. So I kind of have, it's the same. You can find, I manage the social media. So the Burnbox, the_burn_box on Instagram, and on Facebook, it's at the @ at the Burnbox sub. And that's kind of just the Instagram page. I have plenty of photos of the stuff that I feature. You know, you can check out the comments and everything. And it's legit. A lot of people think this thing is run by some huge, it's just me. My wife helps me with customer service and we have a team packing, right? It's not a major operation, you know, it's not. And if anybody's interested in, you know, if you're a firefighter or a first responder and you have a product you think it'd be cool, you know, just shoot me a DM. And yeah, that's it. Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here. I've been a huge fan. I appreciate you taking the time.